I wanted to start a new topic in terms of time here, mitzvahs.
You
want
to why?
What? Will this
help you?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. And that is the topic of the broad topic of kashrus, the kosher laws in general. Spend a little time categorizing them, and in the coming weeks, trying to analyze the reasons that some of the Rishonim and later Jewish thinkers have presented for the kashrus laws. In general, broadly speaking, the various numerous prohibitions that the Torah includes concerning what's called generally machalos asuros, as the Rambam entitles it in his Sefer Kedusha, the forbidden foodstuffs. So it could be subdivided into three broad categories: the Chayvei Krisus, the Chayvei Lavin, and the Yisurei Aseh. Those prohibited foods that carry with it the penalty of kares, or if eaten b'shogeg, the need for bringing a karban chatas as part of the kapara process, which include certain types of blood, the blood that comes out right away, right after shechita. It's called dam she'anesham yotzis bo, chelev, the fats that were brought on the mizbeach. So that's also an isakaris. Other things that are associated specifically with karbonos, which we're not going to focus on, but chelev is relevant to all animals that prohibition applies to. Chelev doesn't apply to anything but behemos. But as opposed to chayos and ofos. And then, of course, you have the one that's much more tempting, if you will. At least nowadays, the Gemara always gives examples about, you have chaylev on the table and shuman. Shuman is permitted fat, and chaylev is forbidden fat. And so, couldn't imagine nowadays people like biting into chaylev. It's not, especially according to current diet considerations. But certainly the most popular of the chiyuvei kares that is certainly tempting is the chametz v'pesach. That also carries with it the penalty of kares. The Torah says quite a few times, starting parashas bo, that also considered a very severe prohibition. Most of the prohibited foods are what we call chayvei lavin. That's the one who eats that is called regular chi of malchus. That's the Gemara Malchus explains that any time the Torah has a negative commandment that's active, and other rules as well, but generally any kind of active negative commandment, if the Torah did not specifically specify what the punishment is, so we assume it's a chi of malchus. So the Torah says thou shalt not eat animals that don't have the two kosher signs as described in Parashat Shemini and Parashat Re'eh. And you're not allowed to eat the creepy crawlies, the shkatzim, or muffin, and by extension, of course, meaning you have to check your produce and other things that might become infested for insects, and maybe your water, depending on which position you go with. So on and so forth. These are the core, you're not allowed to eat treifa, meaning treifa by its core definition means an animal that, the way my Rebbe used to put it, Rabbi Shafi said from Rabbi Soloveitchik, an animal has tissue damage, meaning an animal that internally there's some kind of not just disease, sick animal is not a treifa. I mean, there's some kind of a defect with one of its organs, a hole, an extra node or something that's going to cause it to die within 12 months. So even if it's slaughtered, it remains a treif. And then by extension, the word treif has come to mean anything that's not kosher. But technically, treifa refers to an animal that has some kind of problem with its organs, and even if it's slaughtered, it doesn't come kosher. And then, the most popular treifa food is nevela. Right, that's a burger in McDonald's. There's nevela, and it's kosher meat. That's in a sense a kosher species, but it wasn't slaughtered. So whether these foods are always treif or whether or not there's some process by which one could redeem it from its non-kosher status, such as obviously shechita could say something from becoming an avela. So that's very informative in terms of trying to analyze various reasons behind the various reasons behind behind the kashrus law. So, and of course, then you have kashrus laws that take perfectly edible food, and then through some process they become treif. And then you have basar b'chalav, where you mix meat and milk together. The Torah describes that as chiddushu, in the sense that it could be just, I think it's the only exception to the rule. You don't have I don't think you have any other case where you start with kosher foods and you could do something to make a treif. With carbonos, you have it with a twist. So you could take an animal and make it into a carbon, then mess up the carbon, then the whole animal becomes treif. But that's not in a direct way. So bas v'chalav is called a chiddush, where you take perfectly kosher food and by some kind of process you make it treif. You have other kinds of foods where, under ordinary circumstances, they're perfectly permissible, but nonetheless they have to undergo a process in order to make it kosher. So in the animal kingdom we already discussed shechita, but then in the fruit, fruits and vegetables, so in Eretz Yisrael is well known, and chutzlaretz to some extent, sometimes you have to undergo a waiting period in order to let's say orla, the first 3 years are not kosher, and the fourth year on is kosher. That applies even to chutzlaretz in Eretz Yisrael. You have trumos and maestros. That is as well known, and this is the primary consideration nowadays, because we're not really giving the truma to the kohanim anymore because they can't eat it because they're tamei. And the meiser, at least most, they're not giving to the levim anyway, which is a separate discussion. You know, prove you're a levi, and then I'll give you the meiser. That's the kula that people rely on now. It's not so difficult to prove that you're poor. So the third and the sixth year, so Maaser Ani really should be given to the Aniyim, even though many don't do that either, but that's something that certainly should be done. But what you have with all of these hafrashot, all of these separations, is that before you take them, it's treif. Right? It's not just in order to give it to the Kohen, to the Levi, to the Aniyim, even if for whatever reason you can't do that, but unless you separate it, it's what we call tevel. So both in terms of degree of severity, whether it's kares, alav, I forgot to mention Isuri Asay in a moment, I'll get to that later, or it's in terms of this multitude of possibilities in which it is treif, and many different ways in terms of its status as treif. Is it always treif? Is there something you can make it kosher with? And so on and so forth. So this leads to a lot of complexity in terms of the kashrus laws in general, and each topic on its own, of course, deserves its own kind of analysis then. If you want to analyze why tevel is treif, you can't necessarily explain it in the same way as to why basar b'chalav is treif. They're very diverse laws. For example, maybe the main reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu declared tevel to be treif is to give you incentive to separate it and give it to the Kohen. And even though nowadays we can't give it to the Kohen, but that's the general rule of mitzvot, since there are many layers of reasons, that even when the reason doesn't apply, the mitzvah still applies, as we discussed earlier. As opposed to, let's say, something like basar b'chalav, that maybe that has some kind of danger. So where you're not giving anything to anybody, so you can't say it's declared to be treif in order to cause you to give the truma. So you can't really give one reason for all the kashrus laws. You have to really analyze them each in turn. The ones that are always prohibited, the ones that become prohibited, the ones that are treif but are connected to giving some kind of present to somebody, such as tevel. But today, the remaining few minutes that we have, I just wanted to give some broad overviews to the kashrus laws, even though some of the things we might say might not apply to necessarily all of the prohibitions. Just the one final category of prohibited foods, and that's what we call the Isuri Yaseh. The Gemara uses an expression that there are a few types, but amongst what we want to discuss today, there are Kiyumi Yaseh and Lav Habo Michlal Yaseh. There's an Yaseh like put on tefillin, there's an Yaseh blow shofar, there's an Yaseh give tzedakah. But then there's something that the Gemara calls Lav Habo Michlal Yaseh, and the Rishonim use a slightly different phrase, but it means the same thing, Isur Yaseh, which means not that Hashem wants you to do something, but that Hashem wants you not to do something, but it's expressed positively in the Torah. So, for example, the Torah says, these are the animals you're supposed to eat. So, okay, so you see from me it's a mitzvah to every other night you should go to doggies. Or you should have steak, you should have chicken. There is no such mitzvah. Outside of Shabbos and Yom Tov and certain special occasions, and Rabbi Welcher mentioned the essay of Rav Kook on vegetarianism as an ideal, etc., but leaving aside that essay, which actually is controversial, but outside of Shabbos and Yom Tov, there's no obligation to eat meat. One is not a violation of any Torah precept if one is a vegetarian, at least during the week. Leaving aside the occasions where the halacha seems to mandate the eating of meat. So when the Torah says, Zosa beimo asher tochelu, these are the animals you should eat, that's not a mitzvah, so say. That's not thou shalt eat meat. That's saying that if you don't eat these animals, eat other animals, then you're a violation of that positive statement of the Torah. So that's what the Gemara calls a lava bo michlala say. It's really a negative commandment, but it emerges from a positive statement of the Torah. So, concerning the basic tray foods, such as pork and unslaughtered meat, even had the Torah not added on such a positive statement, anyone who eats, let's say, nevela, violates a negative commandment, lo sochlu kol nevela, and also violates a positive commandment of thou shalt eat these animals and not the other animals. Let's say a pig. Okay, let's make it clearer. If you're eating a non-kosher animal, so that's a violation of the negative commandment not to eat that animal, so it's a violation of the positive commandment to only eat kosher foods. So, but even if the Torah didn't describe it positively, it would still be prohibited, because it said negatively, don't eat non-kosher animals. But there are certain types of categories of treif that are only included in the positive commandment and not included in the negative commandment, which has ramifications in terms of the severity of the punishment. So, for example, of course there'll be some Snickers on this, but not the candy bar, but the Rishonim have a kind of, believe it or not, discussion concerning the human animal, if you will. What is the kasher status of the human animal? So obviously, under most circumstances, there are other reasons why it's prohibited. Murder, not the least of which, Baal Tishaktu, Nivel Hameis, etc. But the Rishonim do have a discussion about the kasher status of a human being, and everyone agrees that a human being is treif. But the question is why? So the Rambam is of the opinion that the human being is prohibited because of that pasuk. So it's Ebimor, Asher Tochelu. He's not of the kosher list, but he's not included in the negative commandment of not to eat a not kosher animal, because he's not really included in the animal kingdom. He's a separate entity. But he is included in Zos Ebimor, Asher Tochelu. That's what the Rishonim have a fascinating discussion about. So why can a baby nurse from a mother? Because anything that comes out of a treif animal is treif. It's not even a liquid that exudes from comes out of a non-kosher species. That's how do you know pig's milk is treif? There's no negative commandment: thou shalt not eat any derivative that comes out of a treif animal. So it's based on psukim that even though it doesn't say explicitly. So that's what they discuss. How come a baby's allowed to nurse? So some say it's bikoch nefesh, but that's an insufficient answer, because in halacha, again, these are the fringe of the halacha, just for the purpose of analyzing the topic. But the human milk is kosher. Not that anyone necessarily want to drink it, an adult wouldn't necessarily want to drink it, but it is kosher. So that's what they discuss based on that Rambam. Why is it kosher? But you do have such categories where certain forbidden foods are prohibited because of what we call an iserasei. And so that's true according to the Rambam for what we call Basar Adam, and it's also true for most things that come out of treif animals. So, for example, pig's milk is not a lav, it's not a negative commandment, there's no malchus for drinking non-kosher milk, but it's an iserasei. We learn it out from a pasuk, it says, Vesbas hayano, you're not allowed to eat the egg of an ostrich. So why does the Torah say now to eat the daughter of an ostrich or the egg of an ostrich? Let it just say now to eat an ostrich. So a few people today point out that no one would want to eat an ostrich because it's very tough meat, because ostriches poke their nose into everything and their meat becomes very hard as a result of it, apparently. So the only ostrich that you would be tempted to eat is a baby ostrich. That's a basayano. That's a few people. But the Torah Shebaal Peh says that another layer of interpretation is that the derivative of an animal may not be eaten. That's basayana. So anything that comes out of an ostrich, you're not allowed to eat. So it means you're not allowed to eat an ostrich egg. So you can't eat. So I think one of the biggest eggs. And from there we derive that you're not allowed to eat the derivatives from any non-kosher species. So the eggs of any treif bird is treif. The milk of any non-kosher species is treif. But that's not treif by the prohibition of the negative commandment. It's only treif by the prohibition of what we call an isserasei. That's included in the list of zos abeimo asher tochelu. You only eat these animals and not that animals, and not the other animals. So anyone who eats a derivative of another animal violates an isserasei. The reason why that's instructive, because hashkafically, in terms of trying to come to grips with the hierarchy of treif, there's a famous Rambam where he notes that even though we generally don't know the schar for mitzvos, we don't really know the reward and punishment for mitzvos based on the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, yet yidei amat schar and shel mitzvos. But he interprets the second half of the Mishnah as telling us that you could gain a little bit of an insight as to the severity of the prohibition in terms of the hierarchy of a mitzvos from the punishment that is given for its violation. So if you have kashrus laws that are prohibited based on that have a prohibition of kares, it seems to be higher up on the scale in terms of severity and how significant hashkafically those prohibitions are by virtue of the fact that they're chayav kares. If you have things that are only chayav ilavin, so those are intermediate. And if you have things that are only chayav yasei, meaning what we call chayav yasei suri yasei, so that's lower down in the totem pole. So obviously all the mitzvahs are important. Rashi teaches us how important it is to keep those mitzvahs that even that you might think are light. You know, as they point out, the space shuttle blew up based on a missing screw, a missing O-ring. You know, it's very small things could ruin one's total picture of spirituality. But nonetheless, in terms of trying to analyze mitzvahs, it's instructive to try to see what the hierarchy is. So, surprisingly, Chamesh and Pesach, right? That's an Itzakaris. That's all the way up there in the top tier of tray foods. Whereas something like adulterated milk or non-kosher milk, so that's all the way down on the tier of kashrus. So this is, again, just giving broad overviews in coming weeks, trying to be more specific, of trying to dissect a, pardon the pun, I guess, but this very broad field of culinary delights, or the prohibited kind of culinary delights in the Torah. By way of introduction, just another introduction, two broad ideas about food in general and what certainly is not a reason for the kashrus laws. In Sifrei Chassidus, I don't read too many of them, but sometime once in a while when they have publications out, and weekly publications, so they quote them. One of them they have here, Olam HaTrufa. So I didn't see this. In that publication, but. And a few sources seem to indicate the following idea. Obviously, everything in life has to have some kind of deeper meaning, because the deepest being of the world, that's the life of the world, the Rebbe Moshe created everything. So in addition to just the practical aspects of the world, there's always going to be some kind of spiritual reason why things are the way they are. Because the Rebbe Moshe could have created the world in many, many different ways. So here, let's take, for example, the heart. So the heart pumps the blood through the body. Okay, so all you have to ask from a medical perspective is what function does it have in terms of preserving the life of the body? But from a hashkafic perspective, I want to know how come it is that you have to have a pump? How come there has to be blood altogether? How come the human being couldn't survive with any other way? So that question only makes sense if you're transcending beyond just the practical and you're trying to ask a religious question. The Ribbono Shel Olam, who could have created the human being in many, many different ways, why did he create him in that way? Why is the heart in the center? How come the heart's not over here? How come the heart's not over there? So from a biological perspective, you'll probably be able to come up with a reason why that's true biologically, the center of the body, so it could radiate the blood down and up. And imagine if the heart was all the way on top. So then to get the blood to the feet would be much harder. And if the heart were all the way on the bottom, to get it up to the brain would be close to impossible. So we'd have to defy gravity even more. But that's an insufficient answer from a religious perspective, because the Rebbe Moshe could have changed laws of gravity too. He could have created myriad possibilities in order to allow life to function. So within that regard, one could, I think, justifiably ask, why do we eat? Why do you have to eat? Moshe Rabbeinu, after all, survived for 40 days and 40 nights without food.
three times.
We just read it in Parashas Mishpatim. Parashas Yisro begins the story. Lechem lo chalti, umayim lo shesisi. So why wasn't everyone created that way? It'd be a lot easier. So the very well she commented humorously. You know that it's good that people get hungry. Otherwise, they get so involved and preoccupied with their life that they just drop dead. Because, but that whole question doesn't make any sense. But why do they drop dead if they don't eat? Let the Ribono Shel Olam create a world where you'll be able. You know, my wife is always telling me, you know, so chaval, I have to sleep. It's what a waste of time. I hate sleeping. It's an interesting perspective. Well, people love sleep, including myself. The Ribono Shel Olam created sleep. So obviously there's a reason for it. So again, so you look in a biology book and you'll see, well, the cells have to recuperate and they have to shut down for a while, you know, like, you know, when you call up your bank or your credit card company and say, sorry, I can't give you any questions because computers are updating. Okay, once in a while, so the same thing with the body. The body biologically has to take a break and, you know, stop tumbling and moving and shaking so it could repair, and that's why healing takes place at night. But that's a purely medical answer. Why did the Ribono Shel Olam create the world that way? He could have created the world in a way where you could self-correct while it's still active. So if you want to answer why do you sleep, hashkafically, you can't just say, well, because there's a health benefit for sleeping. But Hashem could have made the world in a way where you wouldn't need sleeping in order to have a health benefit. So, I mean, you know, the minute you start speaking about sleep as the neshama partially leaving the body, etc. So that's the beginnings of a religious answer. Reconnecting to the Ribono Shel Olam, giving a din v'cheshbon. Okay, this is, we're not talking about sleep, maybe a different time. We're talking about eating. So in Sefer Chassidus, they point out that halachically, food is that which connects body to soul. Right? That if you think about it, that's the link between the physical side of man, the body, and the soul. If the person wouldn't eat, so then they die. You know, the tragedy of death, schematically, is where the soul, which was placed down in this world for a mission, no longer is able to function within the framework and within which it was placed in order to fulfill that mission. So food is the machaber, or it's the joining together of body and soul. So I think it's a very special entity, and obviously has to be sanctified. On a different plane, I think we might have discussed this a little bit before, that's perhaps one of the deeper meanings of why the karbanos are referred to as lechem. Lechem, the karbanos are referred to as bread. Lachmi, they're my bread. So at first glance, chalila, that sounds like paganism, that the Ribono Shel Olam eats bread. What does he need bread for? He doesn't need bread. The Ribono Shel Olam explicitly tells the Nevi'im to inform Klal Yisrael that I'm erev lo amalacha. I don't get hungry, and I don't tell you about my hunger, because I'm not hungry for anything. And so, and don't think that when you give me karbonos that you're feeding a pagan god. That's avodah zarah. Even if the god happens to be Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that's avodah zarah. To think that when one is bringing karbonos that the Ribono Shel Olam is eating. So why is it called lachmi? So in Sifri Chassidut they explain, because lechem is structurally that which connects body to soul. So karbonos are called lachmi, because the Ribono Shel Olam is referred to as the Nishmas HaOlam, the Chei HaOlamim. The world is the physical entity, but that which gives this entity life, that which gives this entity, the universe of the world, meanings, is the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. And not just the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the fact that he literally breathes life into it every single second. So the Karbanos HaLachmi, because Karbanos are Avodas Hashem, and when we connect HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so we bring down HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the world, that he remains connected to the world. But that's why it's called Lachmi in that sense. Very interesting idea. So obviously the food, which the will of God was such that the body should only remain connected to the soul when one engages in what they call the avoda of eating. High level idea to think of, but that's the way they refer to it. The avoda of eating, any cursory glance of Shulchan Aruch, even though it's not so easy to keep these halachos, and it's also hard to think in this kind of way, because eating usually means, you know, go to the pizza shop and on the run, you bite into pizza. But the Shulchan Aruch describes the laws of meals, and you have fat, and you eat this way and not that way, you know, it's even beyond the kashrus laws. There's certain derecheres has to go into eating, and they call from the Gedol Yisrael, they would never eat standing up. Never. They only eat sitting down. How could I eat like a behemoth? There's a certain avodas Hashem in eating. They wouldn't even drink, you know, on the run. Everything has to be established, set with midos, etc. So that there's an avoda of eating. So it's not surprising if the Ribono Shel Olam stresses this avod in many, many different ways. And in a basic way, first he tells us, well, first of all, we have to establish what is the menu. What is a menu that is conducive to religious growth? And what is a menu that is not conducive to religious growth? So within the kashrus laws, you have two almost diametrically opposed, but I think they're linked, ideas and themes that I mentioned. The Minchas Chinuch, the Sefer Chinuch, and the Mor Nevuchim, and the Ramban to some extent on Chumash, for that matter, most of the Rishonim, interesting, most of the Rishonim go with this approach that has been rejected by most of the Achronim, that the Kashrus laws were decreed because the Ribbono Shel Olam is the best doctor, and in order to basically function as an Eved Hashem, so you have to have the body remain together with the neshama, you have to protect your life, and the Rabbi Hashem is telling us this is a healthy diet, it's not a healthy diet. And the Sefer Chinuch writes to his son, that's the way he writes it as a letter, he says, but medical science hasn't discovered what the particular the detriment that this particular food has to health. So he says that's a foolish statement. This is to think that in any era the science of the era is complete and that you have fathomed all of the effects of every single entity. I mean, to take for example smoking, right? 100 years ago they thought smoking was healthy. There are tshuvas that are written that you're allowed to smoke on Yom Tov because it's ochel nefesh, because it helps digestion. When many poskim nowadays hold exactly the opposite. It's not only doesn't aid in digestion, it's unhealthy, and therefore it's a, leaving aside the question of smoking the whole year, which is has its own problems, but smoking on Yom Tov might be doubly prohibited, because how could you light a fire? Maybe you can't light a fire for things that are not directly related to food or to least necessities. And the Rambam writes in a similar way, that they're basically physical dangers. Of course, the Reform got a hold of this kind of approach, and they tried to undo all the kashrus laws by saying that now the current science shows that they're not healthy, so they're not unhealthy, so you might as well eat them. You know, if pork is prohibited because of trichinosis, so now we could cook it, and not a problem, etc., so on and so forth. Rav Hirsch, as well as the Barbanel, I believe, this is all in Rishonim, but the Barbanel, but he, I think, was really a lone wolf there. And he said, it has nothing to do with health, it has to do with spiritual health. The Ribbono Shel Olam made the world in a way where certain foods are conducive to religious growth. And certain foods, in the language of Chazal, metamtim es halev, that they literally they stuff up the heart, meaning they prevent one from being able to receive divine wisdom properly. So just to conclude with this, I would tend to think that they're linked. Even though certainly the more popular approach nowadays is like the Abarbanel and Rav Hirsch, that the forbidden foods is not conducive to religious growth. It's spiritually damaging. But I believe they're linked. And take, for example, I don't know the research on this, but a student of mine said there was once an article printed about the fact that if you wear wool and linen, that could have certain negative health effects. I have to look on the internet. I have to Googleize it to see if I could find something on that. So at first glance, look at the Chochmas Hashem, that he prohibited wool and linen because it has a negative health effect. So I think that, at least from where I've been taught, that the proper way to view it is that you're putting the cart before the horse. The Ribbono Shel Olam prohibited these things because of the fact that they are, within the world within which he created, these are spiritually damaging. That reflects itself in the fact that it oftentimes, not always, but it oftentimes will also have a physical downside to it. And that's ultimately rooted in the famous Medrash, one of the first Midrash Chazal on Breishis of Vistaka Bereisa Bor Alma, that Hashem looked into the Torah, created the world. The world goes in tandem, the physical reality of the world goes in tandem with the spiritual reality of the Torah. Which is why the great tzaddikim, you know, they could perform miracles, like Pinchas Ben Yor, where Pinchas Ben Yor comes to the Yarden, and the Yarden says, I'm following the boss's decree, I have to flow. Pinchas Ben Yor was trying to cross over to Jordan to redeem captives. He says, very nice, but I represent a higher order. I represent the law of Torah. So you are created just to preserve Torah, so you have to split. I come first. So, and then he threatened the Yarden, but that's the way the Maharal explains, that's what he really meant, that he threatened the Yarden. He says, if you don't split, I'm going to put you in Cherem. Meaning what? That you must bend to the law of Torah. There's no way that you, Teva, the natural law, could not bend before Torah, because after all, you were just created in order to allow Torah to exist. So if you want to say that both approaches are correct, the way I would suggest is that it starts off with a spiritual component, that the eating kosher food, and the opposite way, eating trey food, leads to negative spiritual effects. In turn, that oftentimes will be reflected that it also will be medically unsafe as well. Sometimes medical science will discover that, sometimes they won't, sometimes maybe it doesn't even exist physically. But it seems that on a fundamental level, it usually should go the other way. That we start out with the spiritual effects of Shmiras HaMitzvos and the negative spiritual effects of Averos, and then in turn, oftentimes that spills over in a physical way. So it could be that you have a little bit Eilu Ve'ilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, that the Kashrus laws really reflect a physical and a spiritual reality. But I think the main emphasis really should be to pursue why is it from a spiritual perspective that these kinds of foods are not allowed. So we'll try to continue this next week with some specifics about
Anybody that has
my word.
No, you don't like that. I don't want to press you.